Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
It's August 1943. World War II rages over the South Pacific, and on the island of Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands, a U.S. Army sentry has spotted an approaching Japanese bomber. While the air raid siren wails, soldiers scramble to bunkers, others mount machine guns and point them at the night sky. Among those huddled in the bunkers, one individual stands out, Eleanor Roosevelt. The 59-year-old First Lady of the United States is here visiting troops in the South Pacific to raise morale. She knew it would be a dangerous journey, but she was determined to help in whatever way she could. Many are skeptical about the First Lady's presence. William Halsey Jr., Fleet Admiral of the U.S. Navy, believes that having this middle-aged woman around is less of a help than a hindrance. But Eleanor shrugged off Halsey's disparagement. She traveled over 23,000 miles, visiting hospitals, meeting soldiers, flying south to Australia and New Zealand, giving speeches to thousands, and strengthening wartime alliances. But still, Eleanor felt she hadn't done enough. And so, despite Halsey's disapproval, Eleanor flew to Guadalcanal, an active war zone where U.S. forces had landed just 3 weeks earlier. Here, she intends to witness the brutal reality of the front line so she can accurately report back. As she huddles in the bunker and listens to the wailing of the sirens, she prays she'll live to deliver her report. But then suddenly, the sirens fade away. It was a false alarm, and Eleanor breathes a sigh of relief. The crisis is averted, so she focuses on the task at hand. Eleanor spends the next few days tending to the wounded. By the time she leaves, even Admiral Halsey admits that he was wrong to doubt Mrs. Roosevelt, saying, "She alone has accomplished more good than any other person who has passed through my area." Soon, Eleanor Roosevelt will return home exhausted. The terrible suffering she witnessed in the South Pacific will bolster her sense of duty. A duty to, in her words, build the world for which our men are dying. The road to such a world will be difficult. Along the way, Eleanor will experience personal tragedy at a time when humankind is uncovering the greatest tragedy of them all, the Holocaust. But eventually, under Eleanor's leadership as chair of the UN Human Rights Commission, the world will come together on December 10, 1948, to prevent such atrocities from ever happening again. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is December 10th, 1948, the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's April 11th, 1945, 2 years after Eleanor Roosevelt's tour of the South Pacific. A few miles outside the town of Weimar in central Germany, a U.S. Army battalion trundles along a dusty dirt road. From the back of a jeep, a grizzled captain of the 6th Armored Division warily surveys the surrounding countryside, a lit cigarette drooping from the corner of his mouth. Victory for the Allied forces in World War II has been assured for several months. The Germans have been pushed back to their deepest lines. Now, American, Soviet, and British forces are rolling steadily across the continent, swiftly suppressing what few Nazi defenses remain. Today's mission is no different. The captain and his battalion are conducting a routine raid on a German garrison, a compound believed to house prisoners of war. As their convoy approaches the compound, the air becomes thick with a putrid stench. The soldiers gag, cover their noses and mouths. The captain recognizes the smell immediately. It's the smell of death. They stop outside forbidding wrought iron gates. A staff sergeant gives a command, and the soldiers pile from their vehicles, their rifles loaded. but it seems the Nazi guards have fled. An eerie silence hangs over the deserted compound. Slowly, cautiously, the soldiers advance. They enter a courtyard where the name of the compound is carved in large and imposing stone letters, Buchenwald. His rifle raised, the captain creeps forward, braced for a sudden ambush. Tentatively, he rounds a corner, but then stops. There, piled high on the back of a wagon, are hundreds of human corpses, so malnourished they're practically skeletons. Seeing their horrible condition, and the numbers of them, some soldiers break down crying. Even the hardened captain, who believes himself desensitized to war, begins to tremble. Suddenly, movement from across the courtyard makes the captain turn. With shaking hands, he points his weapons at the door of a wooden outhouse. From the gloom inside, a man emerges. He's gaunt and hollow-eyed, dressed in a tattered blue and white striped uniform. The man seems terrified. So instinctively, the captain touches his U.S. Army insignia and softly says the word, American. Upon hearing this, the man steps forward from the building. He is followed by hundreds more. They are all emaciated, skin stretched tight as a drum across their protruding rib cages. And not just all men, but women and children too. Their heads identically shaved, their only identifying feature, the serial number tattooed on their forearms. Buchenwald will be the first Nazi concentration camp liberated by U.S. forces. And as the Allied advance continues, more such camps will be discovered, gradually revealing to the world the full, horrifying extent of the Holocaust. With the war drawing to a close, world leaders will unite in their efforts to prevent such crimes against humanity from happening again. But very soon, something unexpected happens, something that will threaten to undermine any steps taken towards peace. It's April 12, 1945, the day after the liberation of Buchenwald. In the living room of his cottage in Warm Springs, Georgia, the President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, is sitting for a portrait. Dark rings around his eyes suggest sleepless nights and heavy burdens. 2 months ago, with an Allied victory in Europe assured, FDR, as the President is known, attended a conference in Yalta, a town on the Black Sea. There he met with his allies, Winston Churchill of Great Britain and Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union. The three men negotiated the reorganization of Europe after Germany's defeat and tried to establish a vision for a post-war world. Integral to this vision was an international organization of 50 nations, an extension of the alliances formed during the war, committed to maintaining peace in its aftermath. This organization would come to be known as the United Nations. FDR returned from Yalta in high spirits. On March 1st, he informed Congress of his firm belief that we have made a start on the road to a world of peace. But his mood wouldn't last. It soon became clear that one of the delegates at Yalta, Joseph Stalin, had no intentions of stabilizing the balance of power in Europe. Rather than permitting free elections in Poland as promised, Stalin installed a totalitarian communist regime, turning Poland into a puppet state of the Soviets. For FDR, a new threat to world peace is emerging. And with yesterday's revelations of the Nazi atrocities at Buchenwald, the need for peace seems even more urgent than ever. All of this has taken a physical toll on FDR, who has come to his cottage to recuperate. But while sitting for his portrait, the president complains of a sudden, terrible headache. A moment later, he slumps forward in his chair, and in less than 3 hours, he will be dead from a brain hemorrhage. Franklin D. Roosevelt's death comes at a critical moment in the pursuit of world peace. As the main architect behind the groundwork for the United Nations, his demise just days before the UN conference in San Francisco leaves a cloud of uncertainty over the future of the project and the world. But FDR's death will allow someone else to step from the wings and take center stage. Someone who for many years has been quietly and dutifully campaigning for a more peaceful world, and who will now have the opportunity to realize her goal. It's April 12, 1945, moments after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt is in the middle of giving a speech in Washington when she is summoned to the telephone. It's her husband's doctor informing her that the president is dead. Stricken with grief, Eleanor returns to the White House to cable the news to her sons and to change into a black dress. When Vice President Harry S. Truman hurries into the sitting room, Eleanor tells him matter-of-factly, "Harry, the president is dead." After a stunned silence, Truman asks Eleanor if there's anything he can do for her. Eleanor replies, "Is there anything I can do for you? For you're the one who's in trouble now." Indeed, Truman has inherited quite a workload. It quickly becomes apparent that FDR did not brief his successor on many affairs related to the war effort, including the Manhattan Project, the top-secret program to develop nuclear weapons. Many consider Truman out of his depth. Given her proximity to the president and her knowledge of his presidency, Truman sees that Eleanor will be a useful ally in achieving his administration's goals and finishing the work FDR started. And there's one task in particular that Eleanor is well-suited to handle. On April 25th, the first United Nations conference begins in San Francisco. At this historic convention, representatives from all 50 allied nations who declared war on Germany and Japan gather to create the organization's foundational treaty, the UN Charter. The charter outlines the purpose of the organization, above all, to maintain international peace and security. During his closing address, Truman calls the creation of the charter a structure upon which to build a better world and a victory against war itself. The charter established a General Assembly, the policy-making branch of the UN, now responsible for codifying the charter's commitment to equal rights and enshrining these rights in law. But the work is not yet done. Each of the 50 member states must now choose a delegate to send to the General Assembly. For Truman, the perfect candidate for the U.S. delegate is obvious. Eleanor Roosevelt is a committed humanitarian with a profound sense of duty and compassion that transcends international borders. To his mind, she is the first lady of the world. He only hopes she'll accept his nomination. After the death of her husband, Eleanor Roosevelt considered her role in public life to be finished, telling a New York Times reporter, "The story is over." She could not know at this stage that her greatest achievements were still to come, and that the climactic final chapter of her story would contain everything that a life of public service had prepared her for. There were many who believed Eleanor ought to run for office herself, perhaps as vice president. She dismissed these suggestions, publishing an article in Look magazine entitled, "Why I Do Not Run." At 61, she considered herself past her prime. But then, in December 1945, she receives a telegram from President Truman. In it, Truman asks her to be the U.S. delegate to the U.N. General Assembly to help draw up an international bill of rights. At first, she declines. But after giving it additional thought, she decides that she may be uniquely poised to achieve this historic milestone. First, she will be continuing her husband's vision for a post-war world, a vision with which she is more familiar than anyone else. But more importantly, Eleanor believes that a woman's presence could be vital in ensuring lasting peace. In 1946, she writes, "I have always believed that women might have a better chance than men to bring about the understanding necessary to prevent future wars." And so Eleanor accepts Truman's offer. As the only woman in the all-male U.S. delegation, things will not be easy for Eleanor. The other delegates will try to sideline her. They will assign her to Committee 3, which handles humanitarian and cultural questions, keeping her away from the seemingly more important political and financial matters. But Eleanor will make the most of her position in Committee 3, establishing a reputation as a brilliant diplomat and a formidable rhetorician. She will soon be elected as the sole U.S. representative on the newly created U.N. Human Rights Commission and then become its chairperson in April 1946. From this position of influence and power, Eleanor will make history. It's just before midnight on December 10th, 1948. In the Palais de Chaillot, an enormous building opposite the Eiffel Tower in Paris, a large chamber is buzzing with anticipation. Despite the late hour, the people in the room are wide awake. After years of complex negotiations, drafts, and revisions, the UN General Assembly is about to vote for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the first international statement of rights to which all people are inherently entitled. The 30 articles compromising the Declaration include assertions that all human beings are born free and equal, that everyone has the right to life, and that everyone has the right to free speech and free movement. These freedoms are especially pertinent in the aftermath of World War II, when the horrors of the Holocaust and the devastation caused by the atomic bomb are still open wounds in the collective memory. The need to safeguard individual rights, irrespective of religion or nationality, is more pressing than ever. Among those preparing to vote is the principal author of the Declaration, Eleanor Roosevelt. In her role as chair of the UN Human Rights Commission, Eleanor has worked diligently to formalize this groundbreaking document, and it has been no small feat. There have been vocal opponents from the outset. Soviet countries disagreed with the articles that seemed to limit the power of the state, while Muslim nations criticized the Declaration for being too heavily Western-oriented, without any regard for their religious doctrines. To address these issues, Eleanor Roosevelt, a consummate diplomat, gathered research from a wide range of cultures and religions. The Lebanese philosopher Dr. Charles Habib Malik helped Roosevelt craft the language so it would not alienate any one group. And eventually, thanks to Eleanor's leadership, the commission reached a consensus. And now, at 4 minutes to midnight, the General Assembly casts its vote. In the early hours of the morning, amidst the twinkling lights of Paris, the final results come through. The motion has passed, 48-0. Eleanor Roosevelt receives a standing ovation. But this is not a victory for any one individual, but a victory for humankind. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights rose from the ashes of World War II, a war of unprecedented destructiveness, and set out a vision for the world in which everybody has the right to live without fear or oppression. But even today, charitable organizations work tirelessly to protect and uphold these human rights across the globe, to continue what Eleanor Roosevelt started, so that one day, the world we live in might more closely resemble the one she envisioned that night in Paris on December 10th, 1948. Next on History Daily, December 13, 2003. The Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is captured by U.S. forces during the Iraq War. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Music and sound design by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Joe Viner. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.